Welcome to the M&A Zing, a weekly live stream recording of a podcast series devoted to acquisition entrepreneurs, search funds, and holdco builders. This week, we are diving into the next in our series of interviews with successful search fund entrepreneurs and acquisition entrepreneurs. We have with us today Amit Rai, who is co-founder of Astra Holding Group. A holding company that has done two acquisitions in quick succession in recent months, which we'll learn all about shortly, and who provide a long-term home for British industrial SMBs. Amit has incredible global experience spanning top-tier consulting with BCG and McKinsey, senior roles at tech giants like Microsoft and Nokia, and the roller coaster of the startup world, including founding MachineMax, which was successfully acquired by Shell. And he's now applying his wealth of strategic and operational experience to building a portfolio of industrial businesses. Amit, we're honored to have you with us, so welcome.
Thanks, Gareth, for having me as a guest.
Well, thank you for giving up your valuable time. With a growing portfolio, you're in incredible demand, I should imagine, as well as trying to get additional portfolio companies into the group, which we'll certainly get onto in a moment. Before we dive into the questions for you today, I just wanted to share a little bit of a celebration for the launch of Sustainere by Wojciech Buyas, which is a search fund focused on buying businesses in Poland. Lovely to see more search funds kick off in Eastern Europe. So we wish Wojciech and his team the best. So let's get stuck into your history, if you like. If you don't mind giving us a bit of a background on your path to becoming a serial acquirer. Your CV reads a bit like a who's who of global businesses, top consulting firms, big tech, startups. This is a diverse mix. And so how have the sort of experiences that you've gleaned there and the strategy and corporate operational skill set, if you will, that you've built, helped you in this journey?
So there has been two sort of primary drivers behind founding Astra. The first one is actually a personal one, and in some ways it's the biggest driver. My dad ran a successful industrial SME in India, but he had to shut it down because of lack of succession, i.e. me and my brother deciding not to join him. But watching that unfold, I saw firsthand the toll it took on him, his employees, and even his customers, and that sort of stuck with me. The second is sort of the macro opportunity in this area. In the UK, SMEs drive half of the private sector GDP. Half of them, because of the aging population, will be on sale in the next decade or so, and yet 70% won't find a buyer. So there's a big problem with succession in a huge part of the economy, which is SMEs. And within that SME sector, there is a massive opportunity to bring tech to boost productivity. Within my time at MachineMax and in strategy consulting, I've seen how even a little bit of tech can really help boost productivity, especially in the industrial sector. So that's really the reason, decided to found Astra. It sits at the intersection of two things I care about, helping great businesses with succession and using tech to unlock their full potential.
Yeah, tech's played a big role in your life. How have you already brought it to bear? Just sort of talk a little bit about the businesses that you have acquired recently. You bought Interdoor and Acorn MPS, two different businesses that sort of fall under a common thesis or theme for the fund. But how have you been able to bring sort of digital transformation into sort of value creation in those portfolio companies so far?
Yeah. So just to give listeners a quick reminder of what those two companies are, Interdoor is an industrial specialist door maintenance and repair company. They're based out of Hull. And Acorn is a mechanical engineering company that specializes on pipework refurbishment in hospitals and universities. So what you see is, both of them are very engineering-driven companies. They're super niche and market leaders. Now, coming back to your question about tech, there are two ways we think about tech. One is essentials. How can we bring the basics to these businesses? We have gone in and updated the website. We have introduced CRM to them. We are putting in tools that can do monthly financial reporting. It might sound quite simple, but these are things which a lot of these successful SMEs miss because they've never had any reason to invest in tech. So that's one, really fixing the essentials. The second is really looking at the business and saying, what custom tool can we build or bring to the market that will give this company an unfair edge in the market? So we are in the process of building one for Interdoor, which is a door company. And what we're building is a door management platform that the end customers of Interdoors, which are usually large grocers or warehouse operators, can see the status of each door, from a simple app. They can see what is the current status. Is it red, amber, green? When was the last time a maintenance was done? And when is the next time a service is due? And it will start off by entering the data in a manual way. But over a period of time, we will put sensors into these doors as well. So this data is automatically updated, right? So that is what we're trying to bring to the market, which hopefully will give these businesses an unfair edge in the market.
You mentioned the two strands there on the organization, like the rudimentary hygiene things that, you know, I guess we'd all, particularly the folks joining acquisition entrepreneurship from finance, they would probably expect things like Xero and cloud-based ERP or FP&O type software to be rudimentary and there. Have you found that regularly that's not the case, though, that actually simple transformation in that sense can add a lot of better financial control or better margin control?
Yeah, absolutely, right. In two areas where we tend to find businesses not adopting technology is on the customer acquisition side and the customer management side, and second is on the financial side. On the customer acquisition side, you know, things like CRM or website, we routinely find people are not investing in it just because they don't need to. You know, their business is growing year on year. They have more work than they can handle. And, you know, they're not trying to grow 20, 30%. So they don't really invest in even updating their website again because they don't need to. Many of them are not even on LinkedIn. They don't know what LinkedIn is. We have to tell them what LinkedIn is and why in the B2B world, it's an important place to be, right? Again, that all goes to the fact because these are successful businesses. Similarly, on the financial side as well, you know, a question we often get asked is, why do you need financial reporting, you know, outside of statutory reporting? And you very quickly start going into things about, you know, well, how do you know you're managing your cash and you might run out of cash? Well, the most successful businesses are sitting on a pile of cash. They know at the end they make a profit, and the pile of cash year on year just keeps on increasing. So they don't really have any reason to invest in it. Of course, with us coming in and putting a bit of leverage on it, we need to manage cash slightly more in a nuanced fashion than these guys do. So we have to bring these technologies. So we find this quite often that basic rudimentary tools have not been adopted.
And I guess your pursuit of growth is rightly ambitious, and therefore managing cash to be able to invest in growth. But at the same time, finding capital efficient ways of achieving growth at pace in order to grow the bottom line, grow the multiple, et cetera, et cetera. Those are probably a different set of disciplines now, or a different set of conditions that you brought to the businesses that maybe they didn't have before.
Yeah. And, you know, there are two things that we bring in. So definitely digitization. But the other thing we also do is what we call professionalizing the operations, where the biggest question sometimes we do is we step back and say, you know, what's your 1 year plan, 3 year plan, and 5 year plan? And what we find is most people have no clue, right? And again, they don't think like that. They haven't.
They're not often thinking in that kind of horizon.
Yeah, they just don't think like that. And you know, the question is, again, if you're not thinking in that horizon, then you cannot make investments today that will help you 3 years down the line or 5 years down the line. So you know, we do a lot of those sort of soul searching right at the beginning. We give them the confidence that they can go and achieve bigger things, and we are willing to invest where it makes sense. And then we back it up with digital investments as well.
So let's get a bit more into Astra's thesis, if we can. You mentioned the sort of high level and the types of businesses that you've acquired so far, but you're a bit different because you are, instead of being a sort of typical search fund aiming for one acquisition and a later exit, you are deliberately a serial acquirer and a long-term permanent capital kind of home for these businesses. You have talked about your core philosophies behind that, but when you're speaking to sellers, what kind of a proposition as an alternative to sort of trad private equity do you emphasize?
The biggest thing is really legacy and keeping their legacy. A lot of private equity firms and searchers might talk about it, but the reality of the core model is the only way a searcher is going to make money is by selling this business at the end. Now, they might end up selling it to another searcher or another private equity house who might decide to continue with the brand, the legacy, the team, or they might not. So the really don't have that flexibility in their model to think long-term beyond, say, a seven-year period. Whereas in the serial acquirer model, we have that flexibility and the luxury really to think in a perpetual timeframe. And that is something that really, really appeals to sellers. Not all of them want the highest cash. Of course, everybody wants to get as much cash as they can, but they're also asking questions on how would we take care of the team? How would we take care of the customers, their brand, because they want their businesses to outlast them. And that's a promise we can make because our model allows for that.
Does that mean that the sellers in both the businesses so far have been of that sort of generational wealth transfer kind of silver tsunami era, the baby boomer generation?
Yeah, exactly right. In both cases, we have had sellers. In one case, the person was late 70s. The other case, early 70s. In one case, you know, he has two sons. Both are professionals. One is actually in US. He's a partner in a professional services firm. In the second case, the seller had two daughters, one in NHS, one in police, and is not interested in engineering companies. So that's the case where the children are not interested in the business. And, you know, people are thinking about retiring. They want to unlock that cash, not so much for themselves, but actually for their families. You know, this is something that they have created over a period of time, and they want to make sure they're passing on something to the next generation. So that's number one. Number two, they also want to make sure they're taking care of the teams. In some ways, their teams are even closer to them than their children because they've been working with them for 30 to 40 years, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So they do want to find a succession solution that will really help their teams.
We find that so often that sellers are very conscientious about not only their personal legacy, but the continuity of employment for the people that have served them and worked alongside them for so many decades often the case. So yeah, interesting to see that playing out. So what specifically attracted you to each of the two businesses? Were there common traits, or did you assess them each on their merits? Like what motivated you to acquire these specifically?
Yeah, so there's sort of a broader theme we're going after, which is industrials in UK. Part of the reasons to go behind industrial is it's a huge total addressable market. A lot of these businesses are unsexy and they're outside of London. Nobody wants to go live in the places where these businesses operate out of, which essentially makes it not a great fit for searches, which also means that the valuation is much more reasonable than, for example, buying a SaaS business that is based in London, right? So that's one. I think the TAM is huge. The second thing is, having worked with industrial companies and having bought technology to industrial companies, I know here is the case where even a little bit of technology and digital can make a massive impact to the bottom line. And yet it's not an existential threat to the industry. So if you think about AI now, you know, it may or may not be an existential threat to accounting, to coding. But when it comes to fixing doors, you still need humans, right? So, you know, that's the second reason. And then within that, we're looking really for asset-light businesses and more service-oriented businesses. People tend to be scared of service-oriented businesses because your IP, your asset walks out of the door every day. But what we feel is that if we provide good technology behind it, we can lock in not only the engineers, but also lock in the customers. So that is why we have decided to focus on engineering businesses. And even within engineering, you know, we lean more towards asset-light businesses.
Yeah, I think there's the Richard Branson saying, isn't there, with regard to talent around train them so that they're attractive to the competition, but treat them so that they don't want to go and work for the competition. I've butchered that phrase, but the word being, it's a combination of set the conditions to make them want to stay, but part of that being make sure they're the best that they can be at the job.
100%. And there's a very nice virtuous loop that you can build. And honestly, the most successful services businesses do that, which is, if you do good work, your customers will pay you more, which will allow you to have bigger margin. If you have bigger margins, you will pay your people better. If you pay your people better, you will get better people, right? And on and on and on it goes. And that is what we really want to do, is we already have that in place in the businesses we have bought. And with technology, hopefully we can make that loop even better.
Yeah, 100% agree. And then you've got your talent pipelining piece as well, with regards to making sure you're forever bringing, you know, youth through the organization so that you've got that constant sort of availability of engineers, particularly if you're looking to scale. That's often a kind of a bottleneck moment for many businesses in the service space, is finding good technicians, good trade skills to help support that growth. But of course, if you're making the business more efficient and enabling them to do their job more efficiently, then, you know, you can actually grow capacity without growing overhead sometimes.
Yeah, Yeah, and one of the most interesting things I found is engineers love technology. Mm-hmm. You know, you think there might be a perception that you go in and try and put in technology which will improve the efficiency and they would not like it. Quite the opposite. They love innovation. They love growth. And they love the fact that somebody's trying to bring all these new technologies to the business. And that actually becomes a huge way of attracting new engineers into the business as well.
Yeah, really nice to hear of that lived experience there. Going back to lived experience, I suppose, we want to just spend a bit of time on your sort of journey before you launched Astra with Sergey. You had an exit from Machine Max to Shell. Maybe you might be able to speak a little bit about that. But you also, in our pre kind of call, you've talked about some of the failures along the way, the sort of picking yourself up, dusting yourself off and going on to the next opportunity. How has that kind of prepared you for this challenge?
Yeah, so Machine Max, you know, thankfully worked out and we built an industrial telematics platform. We scaled it to presence in 30 countries. At the peak, we were managing assets worth almost $1 billion. And, you know, we managed to exit to Shell and it was sort of successful. But I've had enough failures and, you know, the couple of lessons you learn from going through those failures. The biggest one, whether you want to learn it or not, is humility. You know, it takes a long, long time to build a successful business from scratch. It takes time, it takes grit, and it takes luck. The second one is it becomes quite clear that for long-term success, you need to focus on what I call software, which is people, talent, culture, as opposed to hardware, which is, you know, the addressable market or the product. And again, you know, it's very difficult to rewire a culture which is not working. And so those have been the critical lessons which we bring to Astra. We are not trying to build from scratch. We buy great businesses and help them grow. We avoid distressed assets. If the current owner couldn't fix it, what gives us the right to go in and think we can fix it from outside, right? And that's been the biggest lesson. And once we buy these companies, we continue to over-index on the team and culture because that will... what will keep them great over the next few decades.
Love that. Love that it's people-centric businesses and you're looking at ways into which to augment and empower those people to grow those businesses. That's really great. I think just to your point about not buying distressed, given the way that you're structured, and maybe you can go on a little bit to sort of the capitalization piece of Astra, it's not the sort of risk you can necessarily take with the investors' capital, is it? Let's be honest. So, tell us a little bit about that and how that steers your thesis.
Yeah, I mean, so a bit about our structure. So we're not structured as a fund. We are structured as a private limited company. We bring equity into the holdco, and then we take debt on a deal-by-deal basis today. And as far as the equity is concerned, you know, as we buy more and more companies, the value of the holdco increases and the share price increases. So it gives incentive for investors to come in early rather than late, right? But we really have investors who are thinking about long-term exit, and, you know, it is truly patient capital. And then going back to, you know, how do we deploy that capital in a good way? Again, buying a cheap asset is not necessarily going to bring good risk-adjusted return to that equity capital. You know, something that is expensive is probably expensive for a reason. And as many, you know, smart investors have said over and over again, you know, it's better to buy the right asset as opposed to the cheap asset. And we totally believe in that. You know, we are looking for the right assets to add, not necessarily cheap or distressed assets.
Some of the trained ears and eyes amongst our viewership will have picked up on that discipline and that that focus on the sort of accretive acquisitions, the permanent capital piece. It sounds almost akin to some of the Scandinavian permanent holdcos that we see. I mean, I personally sold my company to and worked for a few years Indutrade. So I'm a big fan of that model, which, as you can just see from their price to earnings ratio, does pay off because when you're trading at that kind of multiple publicly, every deal you do at even like 6, 7, 8x on an acquisition multiple is still accretive to the company, and you recycle the cash from the dividends to the holdco into more acquisitions. So it's a beautiful self-perpetuating model. Are we drawing some inspiration there as regards?
100%, right? I think they are the North Star. We were in Stockholm earlier this year as well. We made a presentation at a serial acquirer conference and we met a lot of those folks. So we love it, what they're doing. They've really championed this model, this notion of having a decentralized portfolio and really trusting in your management team and that's showing, you know, results is insane. You know, a lot of time when I talk to my friends or even potential investors, they can't believe that those serial acquirers have given better returns than even Berkshire over a 20-year period. So this is not a flash in a pan. It's a proven model, and we really want to take inspiration from that model. The only thing we want to add to that in some ways is really bringing the digital and the tech angle. Digital and tech is one thing, which was probably not a big thing, you know, 20, 30 years ago. These guys are still relatively scared of it, but it's also one area where a pure decentralized model might not work because these individual companies don't have the necessary skills. And for them to adopt digital, you might have to give them a bit more help than normally these serial acquirers do. But for sure, you know, they are an inspiration. Sweden is 1/4 the size of UK and has more than 30 plus listed serial acquirers.
And a new one recently with Rocco.
Yes, with Rocco, you know, 3 billion exit, fantastic sort of outcome within 6 years. So I definitely think, you know, 10, 15 years down the line, we are going to have 30, 40, you know, successful serial acquirers in UK as well, and hope Astra would be one of them.
Yeah, we're very bullish, very long on that. We think exactly the same. The conditions are aligning for permanent holdcos, serial acquirers to grow in the UK. You saw Simon Orange recently with Corpac exiting to TDR. Yeah. And you think, well, there you go. There's a progenitor. There's a case in point that you can build a portfolio of companies, even if they are decentralized largely, and you can get a unicorn exit from them. So yeah, more of the same. I'd love to see you leading from the front with that one. I mean, no pressure, of course, to you and Sergio. Let's get it. You talked specifically there about some of the vertical specific tech that you've added, and to think in those terms, you know, with a door company, which, you know, might look a bit prosaic to the untrained eye, but actually to add some vertical specific tech, what particularly were you looking? Was it improving the customer experience? Was it improving the efficiency of the manufacturing? What did you set out to achieve with that vertical specific tech?
So, you know, one is in terms of vertical specific tech, there is huge opportunity in industrials and industrial services. You know, there's opportunity in design, in coating, in field force management, in asset management, right? So there are some recurring themes that applies to pretty much all industrial services companies. Now, when it comes to our approach, you know, we really start from customer first. That's our first sort of set of customers that we're going after and asking, you know, what is the problem that we can solve for you? But the second set of stakeholder are the employees. And in the door company, once we bought it, we went and spoke to the customers and spoke to the employees. And what we figured out was an interesting opportunity. The operators of the doors were saying, look, I have so many doors. I know your guys come in and out all the time across all my sites. But at any given day, if somebody calls me from field and says, what's happening to this door? I just don't have the answer, right? And we bought that feedback and we took it back to the door company, and we said, you know, your customers are saying they don't know what's going on. And there was a lot of emotion. They said, what do you mean? You know, we are constantly telling them over phone. We are constantly sending them PDFs and emails. We're spending a lot of time telling them what we have done. And how come they still don't have the information? And that just told us there's a huge opportunity. You know, everybody is dying in a deluge of data. And what you need is a simple platform where both sides can push it and can look at it, right? So that's it's a real problem that can be solved, and it's something beneficial from both sides.
So you are, in that case, are you providing like an asset lifecycle kind of tracking platform, if you will, for the door? Because you see that being done with like industrial electronic equipment and yellow goods and, you know, HVACs and things like that. But you're doing that with doors.
Exactly. And I used to do something very similar with MachineMax. We provided a telematics platform to manage diggers. And this in some ways is simpler. At least doors don't move. So, you know, there's a simpler technology.
That's really, really interesting. I guess we couldn't talk about tech and digital transformation without talking about the role of AI. And maybe it feels a little bit like a culture clash if you think about it at too high a level, like you know, these traditional businesses that perhaps haven't even embraced cloud accounting software or CRM being potentially asked to adopt AI and use that, you know, deep in their back office processes. Have you gone there, or is it too early?
What's fascinating, Bean, and it has actually surprised me, is instead of pushing AI from top, we see a lot of adoption from the bottom. If you just tell them about AI and give them space to experiment with it. When we updated the website, we asked the guys to come up with the content that goes on the website. And even before we could tell them that there are AI tools to do these things, they had already used it. There is an intern on one of the companies which has actually built an app for managing engineers. And he was showing it to me, and I was absolutely surprised that this guy had built an app in-house. And I asked him, you know, do you have a background in computer science? Do you have a degree? He said, no, I just went to an AI tool, and this tool helped me, you know, make something. I had taken one class in school, and it's amazing. So there is a lot of pull for these tools as long as you give them the space that it's okay to give it a try.
What amazing empowerment, though, like that the you can find this A, that you can find that innovation within your workforce where you maybe didn't think it might come from, which is wonderful. I'm sure you did, but you know, it comes from the oddest places sometimes, doesn't it, where you least expect it. But also that the tools now in this day and age exist to empower somebody in the workforce to engineer their own solution to something and deliver their own you know, efficiencies. That's I don't think we've ever been in a world in the business where that's been a possibility until now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's all about giving them the space, you know, instead of saying, I'm the owner, I have all the answers. We go in and say, we are the new owners who have no answers. Right? We know nothing about the business. So why didn't you guys figure it out? And that empowerment is massive. And we're just seeing so many interesting anecdotes coming because of that.
There's that humility again that you spoke of earlier, you know, in your software and you know, thinking about the need for humility in time and the people skills. The EQ is often underestimated. You know, people think they can fly these businesses by wire and it can all be IQ. But actually, EQ is so, so important in having the hearts and minds follow you in this new direction and overcoming those uncertainties, you know, through the change curve when you buy a business. It sounds to me like, you know, your workforces have responded well to this approach.
Absolutely. You know, they love it, right? And we actually take away some of the traditional owner things. You know, we remove that big chair. If you have to talk to somebody, we say, you don't come to us. We come to you. We don't need parking. We don't drive to these businesses.
It's the little things, though. It's the little things.
It make a huge difference. You know, I can't still get the fact that, you know, if you go in, somebody has to make a cup of tea for you. And it's like, no, I can make a cup of tea for you. I've just come on a train. I'm going to make a cup of tea. Can I make a cup of tea for you? And those little things make a massive, massive impact.
They go a long way, most certainly. So speaking of going a long way, two acquisitions in relatively quick succession. Before we jumped on this call, you were saying this is deals, deals, deals is the... the watchword for 2025 for Astra Holding. What are you doing on the sourcing front these days? I mean, industrial, B2B industrial businesses are notoriously elusive and difficult to find those perfect ones. Obviously, don't give your secrets away, but like, where are you going for that?
I wish I had, you know, trade secrets that would help us, because at this point, it's really about using all tools at our disposal. You know, we, of course, have buy-side brokers and sell-side brokers. We work with accountants. We're using lots of modern tools. I mean, we have, you know, started using BizCrunch, and I'm really, really positive it's going to solve all our sourcing problem, and we will never have to worry about sourcing. So that's coming in. But yeah, at this point, it's really reaching out to our network. The other thing which is beginning to now help us is the credibility because of the two deals we have done, and also the network of the owners from whom we have bought the business. You know, if you treat them well, then they go and tell their friends that these guys are reasonable and you can work with them, right? So at this point, it's a multifaceted approach. If anybody has a secret and they have cracked it, please come talk to me, but we surely haven't.
That social proof, I bang on about that, but that social proof of proving that you're a good home, that you live your values, that it's not all, you know, just marketing speak. Hearing it from the workforce and from the exited sellers that they, you know, they're happy that, you know, it was a good move. All of these things actually create, they're an exponent, aren't they? They create this momentum of their own right where, you know, I found when you are busy acquiring in a space, it doesn't take long for people to start approaching you at the same time as you're out there looking for opportunities. So an abundance of deal flow, abundance of opportunity will be a good problem to have, I think, right?
100%, 100%. That's what we're hoping. And we're hoping you are going to be part of the solution.
Well, we're doing our level best, and we will continue to do so. And we're very grateful for your trust. So let's hope that we can be instrumental there. So let's assume that we are, and fast forward 10 years. And let's think about, you know, how Astra looks as a group or as a whole co in 10 years time. What's your ambition for the size and private/public nature of the business in that decade?
So our aim is to try and go for an IPO 7, 8, 9 years down the line. I think we need to get to the point where we are making a successful acquisition every second month. So a portfolio of sort of, you know, at least 30 to 40 companies. Some of the acquisitions might be bolt-on, but mostly they're going to be independent and we will run them in a decentralized manner. That said, hopefully organized in a couple of verticals, you know, whether it's warehouse and logistics, whether it's building materials. So, you know, 30, 40 companies organized in a few verticals, growing organically at 8 to 10%, that would be the dream. And if that's the case, then, you know, hopefully we can do a good exit, much like Roco.
Yeah, and to do that on the journey to IPO requires you sucking in some additional capital along the way. So structuring it as you have, how have you found the appetite? I mean, I guess, again, exponentially, as you grow the asset base by acquiring more entities, you probably get a few more people inbound to you exploring the opportunity. But what are you doing on the fundraising side at the moment?
Yeah, and I almost look at fundraising in two ways on the equity side. You know, one, there is a huge group of people who have never heard about serial acquirers. They just don't know about it. I mean, to be honest, not to give away my ignorance, but 4 years ago, if you had come to me and asked about Constellation, I would have drawn a blank. You know, having spent my entire life in tech and consulting, I never really heard about Constellation. So there's still a whole lot of people who just think that this model of buying SME assets and running them in a decentralized manner just doesn't make sense, you know, because traditional knowledge says you should take all these assets and merge them into one. So I think, you know, I find myself spending a lot of time educating investors on the power of serial acquirers, you know, whether it's Constellation or indeed the Nordic companies, because they have given us proof points over two decades, which is quite helpful. And then, of course, you know, within a small group of people who get it, who have seen, you know, amazing returns, then we try and sort of sell why UK is an amazing place to be, and within UK, industrials is a good sector to go after.
Yeah, it does surprise me, this assumption amongst the uninitiated that you can only do acquisitions if you want to consolidate and integrate the acquired companies, that you couldn't possibly build a diversified portfolio that doesn't necessarily have everything synergized. I think where, I certainly learned it through watching the Indutrade way and studying the LIFCOs, et cetera, like where you can in the back office get some synergies and where you can provide economies of scale, then great, do so. But actually, the lifeblood of these businesses is their je ne sais quoi, their, you know, what makes them them, and distort that at your peril, because you really don't want to, you know, to stop the music.
And it's because in the industry, and, you know, I've been through a business school, and it's common wisdom in the business market is M&A destroys value. And then if you go a level below and say, why is M&A destroying value? Because what you do is you try and kill the unique culture of each entity you buy by trying to merge them into one. But the lesson that people have traditionally taken out of that is don't do M&A. As opposed to do M&A, but don't try and merge the businesses. And I think the Nordics, you know, figure this out quite well. You know, do M&A, it is value accretive, but don't destroy value by trying to merge them into one.
Wise words, and certainly seeing the benefit of that approach already, I think. I'm just interested in one last question before we get on to sort of the wrap up, but as there is a sort of an increasing landscape of acquirers in the UK, we're still, you know, decades behind the US in terms of the level of competition for good deals. But we do have here, obviously, lower mid-market private equity coming down the sort of food chain. We have trade acquirers that have got their own kind of corporate dev that are looking to grow through acquisition. And business schools are knocking out new ambitious acquisition entrepreneurs at increasing frequency, which is, I think, great for the space because we do have an abundance of businesses that need to be bought. But how are you seeing that firsthand in playing out in deals?
Yeah, I still think we are a long, long, long way away from the point where, you know, 10 searchers will show up for the same deal and they will drive the value up. If you look at even serial acquirers, which are in Nordics, they still buy majority of their business in Nordics, and they've started sort of branching out into the rest of Europe and UK. If you talk to them
about the kind of businesses that they will look at, a very strict threshold.
They're very strict, and
there's a lot on the table, I think.
Surprisingly, all of them look at very similar sorts of businesses in the same geographies, and yet if you talk to them and look at the multiples at which they're buying the businesses in a much smaller part, they're not competing that much against each other. So when it comes to UK, I think we are decades away from the point where this will become so competitive that it'll suck out all the value. Don't get me wrong, it will become competitive, and we do hope it will become competitive. But, you know, getting to the point where, you know, it is completely saturated, I think we are multi-decades away from that.
And I feel that there would need to be some kind of a catalyst. Like in the States, the SBA 7A loan has become this catalyst, which has, you know, put a rocket up the space, and, you know, it's fueled tens of billions in deal values and these SMB succession M&A deals. But here, what do you think needs to happen to catalyze the space?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things is you need people who have made money in this model to be much more public. You know, part of the reason why the tech industry works really well in Silicon Valley, so I used to work in West Coast, everybody wants to do a startup in the tech world because they know friends and family who have made a lot of money in tech. You come to UK, you know, when I used to run tech companies, I was surprised in UK, an average software engineer couldn't care about options. Whereas in Silicon Valley, they'll kill you for that. And the reason is in UK, nobody has really seen anybody make money with options. So they would rather take a little bit higher salary than options, right? So I think success drives success. What we need, what needs to happen in UK is for a couple of searches and serial acquirers to make it big, for it to become public. So that should really increase the demand. And then there are other things, you know, which would come in to simplify. And I think both equity and debt is very helpful. Debt, as you said, you know, something akin to SBA would be brilliant to have it. And the government should really look into that. And then as more and more people make money, the equity flow will also improve. So I think, you know, as more success shows up, things should become easier.
Yeah. So we should kind of encourage more success and more just talking about success and create the conditions for success and almost look for a kind of exponential pay it forward sort of cycle of capital. I couldn't agree more. So this podcast is obviously an opportunity for participants, interviewees to, make themselves more visible to their kind of target stakeholders. So I guess in your case, SME owners that might be interested in, you know, exploring a sale and potentially investors that might want access to the serial acquirer space. Are there some particular core messages you'd like those types of stakeholders to take away from this about partnering with Astra in some way?
100% right. So one, when it comes to SME owner, any and every SME owner should have a succession plan. They should not just think about it. They should have a plan. And it's very, very important. You know, we just saw an amazing business which was doing well. They were at a million EBITDA. They were hoping to get 5 million or sort of enterprise value. But then the EBITDA dropped during the deal process to 0.8. Suddenly that deal fell through. And now because it's dropped just a bit, the new sort of people who are interested were willing only to, you know, put a 4x multiple. And so somebody who thought that they could sell their business for 5 million was getting offers for 3.2. And that's a huge sort of delta. And now they don't want to sell it. But then it just completely destroys their plan, right? So I think it's extremely, extremely important for every person, every SME owner to have a succession plan. And, you know, I would really hope that Astra is part of that plan. So, you know, come talk to us and we can talk about, you know, what succession means. But even if you're a 40-year-old running a business, start thinking about it, right? That's lesson number one. Have a succession plan. It's a bit like insurance, you know, you can't live without it. Number two, when it comes to investors, doesn't matter, you know, where you sit, whether you invest in public markets or private markets, you have to have serial acquirers or at least SME as an asset class that you're putting money into. The returns are, you know, amazing, whether you look at the search fund studies that Stanford or IESE does it, or if you look at serial acquirer, you know, public equity returns, the returns are amazing. So not having SME acquisition in your portfolio just doesn't make sense. So you make sure you're doing it. And then if you want to invest in sort of private serial acquirers, which can give you a tech company sort of upside, while the downside is quite protected because you're investing in profitable assets, you know, come talk to us.
Succinctly put, sir. I on a weekly basis, I'm seeing folks from the venture world that are, you know, if you like, waking up from the coma and all the drugs are wearing off or whatever it is. And actually, they're starting to see through the mist and see the sense of buying cash flowing assets with you know, proven product market fit and established market presence and all of that for much, much lower multiples than they've been paying in the venture game.
So they're beginning to move into this. I mean, I still think their approach is slightly wonky. At least I don't get it. You know, I'm beginning to hear a lot of noise where people are saying, make an amazing tech tool, then go buy all your customers. which are SME businesses, and we still think that's not the way to look at it. Turn it around, go buy a bunch of SME businesses, then build the tech tool which is relevant for them.
Yes, quite. That is a little bit on its head, that model, but you're right. You get the platform, then digitally transform the platform, and then rinse and repeat in with a diversified portfolio. I think there's a lot of sense in that. So great to hear. How do these potential partners from an SMB owner perspective and potential participants from an investment perspective get in touch with you, Amit?
Best way is to reach me through LinkedIn or go to our website and drop a message.
Okay, we'll put a link to astraholding.uk in the show notes, where you can learn a bit more about it. It's one of the better, I think, informational websites about your thesis, and it certainly emphasizes that legacy and humility piece. So I'm sure it's a good deal flow engine for you also. So great, Amit, thank you so much. It's been a really insightful conversation, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. The time has flown by. We're privileged to have you join us on the 18th of June at the Serial Acquirers Symposium. I hope that yourself and Sergey, your business partner, could be there. It's one of those great forum events where we're taking it from the tactical to the practical. So moving away from the sort of academic and more into the sort of lived experience and the real results post-deal. So Amit is a great example there of taking the theory into practice. So do come, participate, learn, visit serialacquirer.uk for your day pass. We'd love to have you there. You're going to be among a good 200 people from this community. So come get involved. You don't want to miss out. Thank you again, Amit. Next week, we're back to our usual format. And then we have some more interviews over the weeks ahead. So do continue to tune in. But for now, everybody, keep on crunching.
Thanks, Gareth.